Good morning. Welcome each of you. We're reading a book at home. I had to think about the comment that was made in the men's Sunday school class there that, how was it said, Titus, that individual that you were talking with from Kansas? We say we're separate from the world, but we're really not, or something like that. And I had to think of this boy. He was a prankster, and he didn't know later years why, but he picked on the one family that was clearly professing Christians in his village. And he thought, well, he would try them out, so he went up this ladder and put a piece of glass across the chimney. Some of you might remember that story and how the smoke started pouring out of the stove into the house. And he said if he expected the man to say a lot of things, he guessed he was disappointed, but he said the look on his face was very much of this earth. When he came out of the house, I had to think of that briefly. And I don't know that I can, how can I say this? I don't know that we as human beings can necessarily get away from having a look of this earth on our face depending what happens, but maybe we can at least control our speech, and God probably continues to refine. And so I guess just thinking about that sort of in the broader scope of some things that were said, you know, I think one of the biggest difference I would say between a Christian, and I'm talking about a real Christian now, and an un-Christian is that if we're really in connection with Christ, we listen. How can I say this? We have someone speaking to us that's greater and outside of ourselves, right? And so when we face difficult circumstances, we listen to a different voice. So we respond differently than when it's just us. And because then our circumstances begin to control us. Okay, I don't know. In some ways, different things were mentioned about the situation in Haiti and other things. And maybe I should have preached about something about trust. That's not where I went. I guess what I have this morning is intensely personal. And in some ways, I have, maybe unfortunately, I don't know, preached some messages on this subject already. But I began to realize how little I know about it. And I'm not sure if I can clearly say what God has been trying to teach me on this, but at least I'll try. I thought maybe if there'd be a few less people gone, I could just skip, because I don't know that I have to preach to benches. I could preach to myself, but I guess since there's a few of you here, you'll have to listen to me preach to myself at least. You know, I've always been of the opinion that it's best or wisest for a teacher to teach what they have already learned. And I would also say you can best teach a subject when your knowledge surpasses the level in which you're trying to teach, right? So I feel like I have a big problem on my hands this morning, because how am I supposed to share on something that I'm very much not sure if I've learned it? I'm trying to. I ask God to help me, but I'm not sure if I have. I guess at the same time, I don't know what else to do, so I'll try. I thought of just moving down with you. I'd found out that people generally don't like to be asked to sit up further in a service, so I thought maybe I should move down and ask them to sit back further, but I need to use the board, so I'll just stay put, and I guess you can too. If you want to move up, you're welcome to. But I would like to have a little help. I'd like to have your definition of a word. How would you define surrender? Anyone? Give up? Okay, thank you. Some more?
Not fighting.
Not fighting, okay. Any more want to add to it? Okay, holding nothing as your own. Just you can keep thinking. Merriam-Webster's has six underneath the use of as a verb and one under as a noun, so you still got about four to go if you're going to cover all of them. Okay. So out of the seven definitions that Webster has, I think only two cover what I want to talk about. And I hope I can convey my thoughts. I feel like I probably struggle some on this. I think surrender, we rightly speak of surrender, we rightly teach surrender, and we rightly preach surrender. At the same time, for myself, I guess I'm becoming aware that often that surrender had something involved in it that I'm not sure really accomplished God's work. And I hope you can understand what I'm saying. So, a lot of times when we use the word surrender, it has or can have the thought of duress. You know what I mean? So just take, Ernie mentioned General Lee of the Confederacy there when he surrendered to General Grant. So in that, to use that as an illustration, Lee was under duress. What else could he do? I mean, he could have mustered his ragged troops that were already defeated and maybe tried to fight one more time, but eventually he was simply overwhelmed by numbers and things. He was basically at the end of the rope. Maybe he could have drug it out another day, another week, another month, maybe even another year, but eventually he was done for. So he, as a logical person, decided that I'm under duress. I can't. This is a dead end. I have to give up. Going to another definition we had. Sometimes also sort of the same thing, but pressure. Also surrender oftentimes the way we use it has the thought of force, right? Some degree of force. If Grant didn't have the whole Union Army standing behind him, do you think Lee would have surrendered, so to speak? No, there was force. There was the ability to enforce something. And so I understand that all these, maybe to some degree, that God has the ability to use duress, and maybe he does to some extent, but I would hesitate to say, would you say God forces anyone to be a Christian? So I don't know, maybe it becomes a fine line here, because he does bring conviction, right? Sometimes he brings trials, sometimes he shows us our inadequacy, so he allows things at times, but at the same time, at the end of the day, it's choice. So I'd like to bring this back to my message title that I'm going to call Choosing Surrender. Choosing Surrender. So out of the seven definitions that Webster's had, the two that really fit in the way I want to think of it for myself is to cease resistance. To cease resistance. Now, of course, you can cease resistance because you don't have any choice. I understand that. But to me, I'd like to think of it more as voluntarily choosing to cease resistance. I could potentially have other choices, have other options, but I choose to cease resistance. The second one that I wanted was number six. And I thought this was actually pretty good for a secular dictionary. To unrestrainedly give oneself over to something or someone. To unrestrainedly, or unreservedly would fit in there just as well. To give oneself over to something or someone. I'd like for you to, I don't know, you're welcome to turn these verses at the same time, maybe just listen to them. Luke chapter, I got two passages in Luke. The first one's Luke chapter 2, verse 34 and 35. Simeon blessing Christ says this, and Simeon blessed them, Jesus and the parents, Mary and Joseph, and said unto Mary his mother, behold, this child is set for the fall and the rising again of many in Israel. And I would suggest not only in Israel. And for a sign which shall be spoken against. Yea, a sword shall pierce through thine own soul also, that the thoughts of many hearts may be revealed. You know, Christ in his coming did not come to force you and I into a life of Christian service, but he came to reveal our thoughts to ourselves, I feel like, right? To give us the opportunity for choice in this surrender business. Listen again to Luke chapter 20, verse 17 and 18. Luke chapter 20, verse 17 and 18. And he beheld them, Christ, and said, "What is this then that is written? The stone which the builders rejected, the same is become the head of the corner." In other words, that which was said is unusable is become the key of the whole building. "The same is become the head of the corner. Whosoever shall fall upon this stone." And when he's talking of himself, and when we fall upon Christ in the way he's referring to, it's not an accidental stumble. It's just a wholehearted giving of myself. A voluntary falling on the stone shall be broken. It hurts. It's not fun. But then he does go on. I think he's talking about the judgment. "But on whomsoever it shall fall, it will grind him to powder." So in time, we choose to fall or we choose not to fall. There's no coercion necessarily involved on that. I'd like to go to 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 4 through 8 now, talking same passage out of the Old Testament and Psalms. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 4. To whom coming, as unto a living stone, or alive, growing, strong, living stone, disallowed indeed of men, again pushed aside by men, but chosen of God and precious. I'd like for you to consider that thought, or that phrase, "and precious." Ye also as lively stones, so we can also have the opportunity to be alive, to be part of this building, are built up a spiritual house and holy priesthood to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God by Jesus Christ. Wherefore, also it is contained in the scripture, "Behold, I lay in Zion a chief cornerstone, elect," and again that word, "precious. And he that believeth on him shall not be confounded. Unto you, therefore, which believe, he is precious. But unto them which be disobedient, the stones which the builders disallowed, the same is made the head of the corner. And a stone of stumbling, and a rock of offense, even to them which stumble at the word, being disobedient whereunto they were appointed." I don't know, I face temptations in everyday life. I don't know what yours are. But if you resist temptation, why do you resist temptation? If you do. What is in your life that makes you resist temptation? Is it because you were always taught that it's wrong to cheat, for example? It's been a little bit of a tough year, at least for us in business, with all the price increases and stuff. Sometimes it's hard to know where you're at, and you're losing money here and hemorrhaging it there. So why not just... I know I deal with a couple companies that absolutely don't keep track of why I bill them what I do. So I could add a little here, cheat a little there. What? Why don't I? Is it because I was taught that cheating is bad? Is that why? Is it because I'd be scared I'd feel guilty and have to confess it sometime? Is it because, why? You get the threat. What else? There's all sorts of temptations. Why don't I give in to temptation? Is it because Christ is precious? I want to say this carefully. I'm sure there's lots of different reasons why we don't give in to temptation. And I don't know everybody's heart at all. I know my own. But I want to just be honest about my own. Is too often, even when I'm resisting temptation, it's not because Christ is precious. It's because of other things, other reasons. Is Christ precious to you? Looks like some people are tired, so I'm sorry I'm being boring. Would you all just stand up? Need to stretch? Go ahead, I'll give you a minute. And here's where this, I guess, subject is so intensely personal for me is... I thank God I've grown up in a Christian home and no way despising that. But I very much see a need in my life that so often I'm yearning to do things, and my reason for not falling into sin, if you want to say it that way, is not necessarily because Christ is precious to me. It's more because of training, because of thoughts of this, because of what would happen or the confession I would have to make or all that. And I'm not saying that shouldn't, I'm not saying we release people from the need to confess and all that. At the same time, if Christ isn't precious to me, isn't it any wonder that I struggle in my Christian life to some extent? And if you think you can stay awake, you're welcome to sit back down. I don't know, maybe I don't want to misuse. This was a story that, I don't know, I'm sure some of you read it. How many of you know the book Call of the Wild by Jack London? A couple people. I'm not here to promote the book, but I was asking God for some illustration to try to say, to use for where my thoughts were going somewhat. And of all things, of all the stories that I've read in the years, that one that came to mind. So I'm going to only use part of it. I understand that. Not the whole book. And I don't think Jack London ever intended for his book to be used in a message. From what I know about him, I don't think that would have been his goal at all. But if God can use it, praise him. If it's a distraction, I'm sorry. For those of you that know this story, it's about a dog, Buck, I believe. And I didn't reread the book since this came to mind, so if I've got some details wrong, I'm sorry. I'm not trying to misconstrue anything. Begins with this dog, Buck, in California on a big estate, well cared for, well loved, and I guess we could say at peace at home, enjoying the life of a good dog. Thinking nothing, desiring nothing more. Yes, he did have some vague, undefined dreams, but they didn't materialize into anything definite. And in that way, so I'm going to go on and tell more of this story for children's level. But for the rest of you that want to take it to another level, I like to think of his time there as the time of innocence, right? Fairly good. A good life. Not much going, not much to think about. Anyway, one day a person he trusted and considered a friend on this estate betrayed him and sold him. And so as he was transferred from one person to the next, he didn't understand what was happening. Just as a person comes to the age of accountability, doesn't really understand what's happening, but he knows things are changing. And as he was chained and then crated and ill-used, he wasn't given water as I recall. You know, he eventually turned into this maddened, raging beast of a dog. I'm going to call that the time of awakening, realizing that the tranquility, the innocence, the peace that he had at home really didn't exist everywhere else. Sort of a parallel to my own life. You know, in this maddened and raging condition, he was shipped to a man, I think it was in Seattle, whose job was what I'm going to call dog breaking. And so they brought this crate in with this raging, mad dog, basically. And they brought this crate in, and this dog trainer gets a hatchet or whatever he had there, a pry bar, to open this crate to get this mad dog out. And he pries as he begins to pry that crate open, all the other people that were around scrambled for cover because they thought they knew pretty well what was going to happen as soon as that beast gets out of that crate. And so as the man tore up the crate on the outside, the dog tore up the crate on the inside, and pretty soon he was raging free, he thought. So he came ripping out of the crate into the area they were there. And all the other people were on top of wagons and boxes and out of the way. And here was just this man, just this dog training man, and all he had was a stick. You know, the dog in his rage, Buck in his rage, directed all of his energy and focus on tearing up the man in front of him. As he rushed at him, as he leaped at him for his throat, something caught him and sent him spinning. And I know I'm saying this in my own words, but Buck, confused and unbelieving, jumped to his feet and rushed back to the attack. And again, even more ferociously this time, he launched himself at the man. Again, he was sent spinning end over end. Over and over again, he did his best to have his way, to tear, to destroy, only to be met by punishing blows and defeat every time. He became so maddened that he basically went insane. And at the peak of his pain and insanity, The man used his stick to deliver the most painful and stunning blow that he had up to that point. You know, as that dog lay almost senseless and powerless, the man then stooped down and fondled and handled him some, something the dog would have never allowed to a stranger before. I think to me that's a parallel of when I met the law. You know, we rage, we tear, we try to have our own way, we take our own way, but we're brought back by conscience, by guilt, by despair, time after time, till all we know is defeat. And in that is probably where many, I'm not going to say all, many then become willing to ask Christ into their life. And I am not negative about that, but I think too many of us stop there then. Okay, going back to the dog. You know, Buck, while we could say he was broken to the law, he didn't ever really become reconciled to the law. But there wasn't really anything he could do. He had to live with the law because he knew the consequences of not living with the law. So he spent years under the law, so to speak, somewhat submissive to it, yet never wholly reconciled to it, living in outward obedience to what the law required and what he knew would bring punishment, but yet always studying, always considering, at least in a dog's way, how to work with it and even on how to work around it. That was how he lived his life. That's a little bit how I live my life. Eventually, through the process of law, Buck became the property of some very unwise and foolish people. Those of you that read that know where that goes. You know, overworked, ill-treated, the day came when he was asked to do something he knew was dangerous, and he finally decided he just had enough. He lay down, and he refused to move. The law in the form of his master began to beat him, and beat him unmercifully, and would have likely beaten him to death, except for the interference of another man. Again, if I may flash to the side a little bit. I'm becoming more and more convinced that when we see people leave truth and walk away from God, it's when they've reached this place in their life with the law. This other man, back to Buck, saved him from death, nursed him back to health, gave him something he had never fully had before, a relationship. You know, that relationship began with the rescue from brutality of the law and almost certain death. But that relationship morphed and grew into a relationship of love, of devotion, and absolute obedience. In fact, the dog grew to have such an admiration of this man that he was willing to try anything and do anything for this man with total disregard for himself. Even at one time as a joke, the man asked him to jump down over a cliff to what would have been certain death. And I think as the story said, they found themselves scrabbling at the edge of the cliff trying to hang on to him because he was willing to jump. The dog had met and responded to love. I'd like to put that into your own life now. But where are you in that journey? May I read Romans 8, verse 2 through 4 to you? For the law of the Spirit of life in Christ Jesus has made me free from the law of sin and death. For what the law could not do, in that it was weak through the flesh, oh how weak, God sending his own Son in the likeness of sinful flesh, and for sin, condemned sin in the flesh, that the righteousness of the law might be fulfilled in us, who walk not after the flesh, but after the Spirit. Friends, I'd like to propose to you this morning that walking after the Spirit is having a relationship of love with the Master. A willingness to jump off the cliff if that's what he tells you to do. A total disregard of myself. Forgetful of self. You know, the lesson of the law was and is a necessary part of the process of bringing the understanding of love. Without having conflict with the law, I think it would be impossible for us to grasp any of God's love. Would you agree with me? You know, that terrible time with the law, why did God give the law? As a man, sometimes it's like, wouldn't it have been better to just get rid of that? But no, without the law, I wouldn't be able to see God's holiness. I wouldn't be able to see my inability to accept love, even. I needed the law and my total chaos with it, conflict, to be able to accept love and appreciate it. Yet, at the same time, that law does bring tremendous danger. If I stay in the law, it brings discouragement. It brings a resignation to never arriving. It brings a giving up on having victory, on life itself, and finally even death is welcomed. Again, I would like to, again, I wonder if many, if as many or maybe more Christians have been destroyed spiritually by the discouragement of a law focus as have been destroyed by deliberate rebellion. Discouraged focusing on the law. You know, it brings up a question I've had many times, and I don't know that we avoid this. But the question, why God, and then whatever that is for you, is either a very beautiful question or a very dangerous question, depending on how I relate to it. If I'm under the law and I ask why God, it becomes very dangerous because eventually there's no use in me trying anymore. If it's why God in surrendered resignation to his will, then it can build something good. You know, the surrender God seeks is not so much one of giving up. It's true. Giving up is a right use of surrender. I'm not picking on that definition. But the surrender God seeks is not so much one of giving up as it is one of giving in. The surrender God desires is not one of defeat, but a surrender of desire for conformity. Yes, conforming in love does mean I give up my plans, I give up my will, but it doesn't mean that I give up on life, that I give up on love, that I give up on peace, or that I give up on finding rest. In fact, the path of surrender is the very path of life, of peace, of love, and of rest. May I use one other illustration? I'd like to think of marriage briefly. And it doesn't really matter whether you're married or not. We all are human enough, I think we can work with this one. I'd like for you to especially consider the spirit and the attitude of the bride. In fact, I think we have a wedding to go next weekend. So I don't know, maybe I could use them as an illustration. To some degree, a bride fills a more parallel role in a marriage to what we do in our spiritual relationship with Christ, and that's why in this message I'm focusing on that part of it more. You know, how sad, how almost depressing or repulsive, whatever, I don't know what the right word is, would it be for that bride next Saturday to enter into marriage because of coercion? Or a feeling of resignation and hopelessness rather than of joy and delight. Wouldn't that be terrible? And I'm not that couple, I have no worries about that. I'm just saying, how would it be? If you came to a wedding and you knew that the bride was simply going through with this because of force, coercion, feelings of resignation, not really having any other good options. I'm just going to do this. If you knew that, you would rightly be concerned about the future of that marriage, wouldn't you? You know, the attitude with which a bride builds a good marriage is that of willing gladness at the privilege to wholly give herself to another. She lays down her dreams, her plans, and her life goals so as to fully share and participate in the dreams, the plans, and the life goals of her husband. Well, at least that's how it should be. We being human, I'm not saying that's always accomplished. You know, and sometimes all brides are human, so they probably struggle with it down the road, even if they don't on their wedding day. And you know, many a well-meaning wife, marriage destructs by having some agenda and or program of her own that is somewhat separate, somewhat off to the side or something from what her husband and his goals and life work is. And this unfailingly brings conflict into a marriage. It will always do it. It's human. It's normal. I'm not trying to be harsh. But you're asking for trouble in your marriage, wives, if you do that. Once you're married, I wholeheartedly believe the best way for you to serve God is to support whatever your husband's asked to do. If you have a separate one, you're going to make problems. Anyway, I'll let that there. But unfortunately, this problem of having an agenda, of having goals of my own, are not unique to a wife. Many is the Christian who has tried, is trying, and will try to, in some degree, have their own agenda, their own program, a program of their own plans, their own will. And it unfailingly brings conflict into their spiritual life. Let me just ask yourself this. Is there conflict in your relationship with Christ? I have to say for myself, there is at times. Now, I know many people that glibly say they don't have that problem, so maybe we got to ask a few more just in case. Is there conflict in your relationship with Christ? Then let's ask, is there conflict in your Christian life? If it's not in your relationship with Christ, is there conflict in your Christian walk of life? If that's not far enough, and I know this next one can be dangerous because there's always two sides to a relationship, at the same time, I'd still like for you to consider this. Is there conflict with God's children? If you answer yes to any of those, unless you're not human, I would propose to you that somewhere, something in your life is not fully surrendered or hasn't been. You all disagree with me? In the spiritual arena or area, conflict almost always, if not always, has some roots in agendas, in plans, in will of my own that I am clinging to that is separate from God's will and plan. If you find yourself in conflict, you do very well to always stop and ask yourself, why is there conflict? And maybe I'm just exposing myself, but you know, I've been in conflict when I was right, and I've been in conflict when I was very much in the wrong. But I will tell you, even when I was right, most of the conflict was coming because of Joe's problem. Even when I was right. Maybe you're different, and I hope you are. Do you know what it is to have a knot of fear in your middle? I don't know how to describe it, but you know, just that tight feeling. Just not at rest. Fear. I don't know. Some of us, if we get really scared or uptight, I get heartburn, you know what that is? To the extent that I can get like a sour taste in my mouth. You have that? I don't know if anybody has that exact one or not, but whatever it is for you. Do you know what it is to be on the verge of panic? Something just has to be this way or has to be that way. Do you know what it is to wonder if you're almost on the edge of breaking mentally? Snapping? Something must give. Something has to change. I just can't stand this anymore. Do you know what it is? Maybe this one is the most sinister of all. Do you know what it is to pray about the same thing over and over and over again? Do you know what it is to wonder and even cry out, God, where are you? Do you know what it is to wonder why God doesn't answer or doesn't respond to your prayers? Again, I can only speak of my own experience. But for me, to some degree, any certain one of these, and actually all of these, come at least in part from failing to make the choice of surrender. A choice of surrender. And again, in talking of surrender this morning, I'd like to heavily emphasize, yes, God does bring conviction. He does send His Spirit and all that. But at the end of the day, the surrender I want to seek for myself, the surrender I'm speaking about this morning, is a choice that I have to make. I have options. As long as there's time, anyways, I can always find some other way to cope. And even many Christians are coping. They say they're surrendered, but they're coping rather than surrendering. And that scares me for myself. And one place maybe this surrender shows up as much as anything is in the question of, do I have any rights? Do I have any rights? And to be honest, I feel sometimes like I do. A right to at least a little something for self. Maybe it's a right to a certain kind of music. Maybe it's a right to have some of my own money to spend it how I want to. Maybe it's a right to have a good job. Maybe it's a right to run my own business. Maybe it's a right to use my own time in my way. Maybe it's the right to a good reputation. Maybe it's the right to make some plans for myself. Maybe it's the right to choose my own friends. Maybe it's the right to have health. Maybe it's the right to be part of a church that does things the way I think it should be done. Dear friends, I'll just tell you this morning that when I think I have a right, I begin to destroy the very gifts God has already given me in trying to hang on to what I think I deserve. Is that what you want to do? You want to hang on to something that you feel is your right? I know some of these are awful hard to give up. Just take health, for instance. Yeah, God be with you, Ernie and Will. I'm not trying to say it's easy. But when I am asking God and I'm saying, God, you owe me this. I can have this. There's no more sure way to lose everything that matters than to think that I've got a right to it. Have you surrendered all your rights? Have you chosen to yield all? You know, the amazing thing is, whatever we have, what we long for, is God has far more to give us than we could ever handle. Yet when we're pursuing our rights, He's got to shut that valve off so that we know how little we are. Dear friends, today, let's live for Christ. Not in anxiety of His displeasure, but in the desire to be wholly pleasing to Him. Not in the fear of rejection, but in longing to be fully united with Him. Not in the dread of separation from Him, but in a passionate longing to be in His presence for eternity. I'd like to just repeat some things. In the spiritual arena, conflict almost always, if not always, has some roots in agendas and plans and will of my own. The surrender God desires is not one of defeat, but a surrender of love and a desire for conformity to and with Him. The path of surrender is the very path of life, of love, of peace, and of rest eternal. 2 Timothy 1:7-9. For God hath not given unto us the spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind. Be not thou therefore ashamed of the testimony of our Lord, nor of me his prisoner, but be thou a partaker of the afflictions of the gospel according to the power of God. Be a partaker of the afflictions of the gospel according to the power of God, who has saved us and called us with an holy calling, not according to our works, but according to his own purpose and grace, which were given us in Christ Jesus before the world began. Oh, that I could live that way. Please pray for me, that I could serve God in love, in power, in love, and in a sound mind. Let's kneel for prayer.
Dear Father,